getting a new segment on types of love. It can be such a expansive conversation when we're talking about love. And so we like to sort of break it down into digestible pieces. Like, how do you talk about love? How do we talk about love? How do we as a culture look at love? And so that's what the next few weeks are going to be focused on. Adam Mose and myself are going to be diving into even a new perspective on that, where the East and the West philosophies meet in the topic of love. So it will be a very thought-provoking full hour talking about love, expanding our minds, expanding our hearts. And we invite you to not only tune in, but call in. The number's 895-1114. That'll get you right on the air. And let us know where your thoughts are around the topics of love and what we're talking about. So I'm going to get this hour started here with some Beatles. Love is all you need.
Say, but you can learn how to play the game. It's easy. There's nothing you can make that can't be made. No one you can save that can't be saved. Nothing you can do, but you can learn how to be in time. It's easy.
Love in the 21st Century is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Cozy Studios, presenting the Claymates Annual Holiday Art Show and Sale, Friday, December 9th from 4 p.m. to 8, and Saturday the 10th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. You'll find mugs, bowls, platters, jewelry, fused glass, ornaments, paintings, cards, light switches, and more. Cozy's studios are located at 356 East 2nd Avenue on the corner of Laburnum Avenue, inviting you for some holiday cheer, art, and friendship. Welcome to Love in the 21st Century. We are beginning our installment tonight on types of love. And I felt it beneficial to start with some wise words from someone that I admire and appreciate quite a bit. His name is Jason Silva. For anybody that doesn't know who Jason Silva is, he is, I believe he calls himself a modern philosopher, and he is the host of a TV show called The Brain Games. Not sure what channel that's on, but anyhow, he is well spoken and well thought, and this is a short segment on love.
Oh my God, love is, oh man, love is immortality. Love is listening to a beautiful song that induces a cathartic, emotive transcendence. You know, love is goosebumps. Love is aesthetic rest. Love is to be beheld. It's what the poet Roland Barthes calls fulfillment, that which exceeds totality, literally, to be more than full, that you spill over. You know, love is catharsis, love is tears, but tears that feel like a orgasmic release of emotion. Love is infinity. Love is what you want to stretch on forever. Love is living inside of a pop song. Love is, you know, that Richard Linklater movie, Before Sunrise, you know, when two lovers meet on a train on the way to Vienna and spend the whole movie, the whole evening together talking about life and love and death and fear and anxiety and connecting two minds, two souls, literally merging into one another. And the evening that holds the possibility of immortality, right? True love that will save us. Remember the religious solution, the romantic solution to the death problem? So love will save us. But in that movie, which takes place almost in real time, dawn then arrives, right? And that's love's aging. That's the inability to bear love's aging. There's that scene when it's morning and you see his face all melancholic because he realizes that the night is over. And not that he loves her any less, but that life goes on and he has to go and they'll get busy and task-based existence will start seeping over into the fantasy that they were having the night before. And then he sits back and he looks at a clock and it's Vienna and it's historical and it's beautiful. And he goes, and all the clocks in the city began to whir and chime. Oh, let not time deceive you, you cannot conquer time. In headaches and in worries, vaguely life leaks away and time will have its fancy tomorrow or today. Love is the beauty and the promise of immortality, and also it's the joint mourning of lovers that know that they might die. And so, love is the answer to the problem of human existence, but it doesn't solve the problem of human existence.
Interesting and thought-provoking, and though not necessarily directly where we're going with the conversation on love tonight, somewhere to definitely start. When we talk about love, when we think about love, it's, you know, often we kind of get zeroed in on the romantic love, the Eros type of love, and tonight we are going to just paint more of a larger perspective and a broader landscape. And so thank you so much, Adam, for joining me.
It is always my pleasure.
Awesome. And yeah, we're going to dive into a different sort of direction on talking about types of love. Would you like to share a bit?
Yeah, I would, of course, be the ever rebel and saying there isn't any types of love. That making types and creating typology is a natural process of the human mind. Mm-hmm. It's how we project and what we put on nature or the absolute or perfection. We chop it up into little pieces and we make it sensible,
right,
to ourselves. But ultimately, those types of types and labels and projections of divisions is a reflection of our own psychology.
Mm-hmm.
They don't exist independently. What I'm saying is, like, love is one of these practices, something that you actually can get better at,
mm-hmm,
as you explore it, as it becomes like a meditation,
mm-hmm,
something that you can engage in on a personal level. In that sense, the love is like, they say, an immeasurably great catalyst of being. And I'm always coming back to it. It's one of four.
Mm-hmm.
We could have three other shows,
mm-hmm,
about compassion, about joyfulness, and about equanimity.
Mm-hmm.
That these are the qualities that basically are. They are there. And they are immeasurable. They're unfathomably vast and continual, you know, that idea,
right,
of atemporal. Before our sequential idea of time comes into play, these just are. So as we practice them, we become, you know, more attuned to this realm, which is just being, which, mm-hmm, is just vastness and equality and purity. And we say, oh, the great love revolution, you know, there'll be world peace possible on the planet,
mm-hmm,
because enough individuals, enough humans are coming from a space of love and forgiveness and kindness with one another. That's the idea. If enough humans start practicing and making love a priority, then we just have a beautiful future.
Yeah.
As a species, we get all of our stuff. We get over ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And to sort of do the compare and analysis thing about what you're saying versus the typical Western Greek philosophy around different types of love, it sounds like that there is four that you just explained: love, compassion, joyfulness, and equanimity.
Yeah.
And I would say that those are definitely wrapped up themselves as well into the way that the Greeks describe love.
Mm.
And so it's just interesting to look at those two things in comparison, but also just wanting maybe to dive a bit deeper into what you're explaining as the practice of love. Because I think one of the reasons that as you were explaining, like the dissecting and categorizing is something that the human mind does, and it makes sense for us in our lives to some extent, is it does just that. It helps us to make sense of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in my understanding of Greek philosophy and how it sort of sectioned out, it's, is that most people can identify well with the way that I love my brother,
mm-hmm,
isn't the same way that I love my partner, mm-hmm, my lover. Mm-hmm. So it helps to make sense of, like, okay, this is still love. It's just a, you know, and it's all love,
mm,
but maybe that the love changes shape and form when you are loving one individual versus another.
And these are very valuable differentiations that we make, to help gain like a healthy sense of ego,
mm-hmm,
a healthy sense of one's identity and one's agency, that is like how you are in the world. And then when we're looking at it from the Eastern perspective, the mystical, we might even say, the ordinary categories and the way that we divide up the world and divide up our own experience,
mm-hmm,
ultimately is something you got to let go of. So this way of making the world sensible and navigable through the different maps, these are like maps,
mm-hmm,
ways of looking at something. We can't mistake the map for the territory.
Right.
And when you're actually out in the woods, you know, it's a different experience about than looking at the what the woods are going to look like on your map.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we mean. Like, the practice of it is when you're in it and it's in you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that's the amazing thing about love, is that we all have these very personal experiences, the most powerful experiences in our life. And from my own story, I can say, when I first met my first like spiritual teacher, his name was Ganesh Baba, and I met this woman who later would become like my spiritual mother. And she said, oh, when this guy comes from India, you got to meet him. She saw one of the movies I made and thought that I had kind of a hidden spiritual aspiration. And she was right. But when I first met him, I thought they were lovers. The energy between Gina and Ganesh Baba was so juicy and beautiful. It's like I had never seen two people in so much in love. And from where I was, I conflated that with erotic love. That's because that's what I knew. You know, I was a young guy. I think, you know, like 18 or 19.
Mm-hmm.
But theirs was this spiritual bond, and I didn't know what that was. Had never met that before.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, Gina's daughter came along. I ended up being able to drive Ganesh Baba to the hog farm, the Grateful Dead land, because he was their guru. He was going to give him a blessing. But seeing how Gina's daughter also had this thing of service, like this respecting the elder. Ganesh Baba was 95 when I met him.
Mm.
But that type of service love, I had never seen that. So we get these lessons
mm-hmm.
in life, and they're felt, you know, you can feel them inside. And the Greeks, not only is it, you know, something these guys thought up and looked at the world through long ago, but you see in terms of our literature and the psychology, our mythology in our Western world,
mm-hmm.
it's all throughout. It's like the water that we're swimming in.
Mm-hmm.
It's the view that we're looking at the world through. Then I stepped over and I looked into the Eastern worldview.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the water that we're all swimming in.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I was flying in the air of Eastern thought. I'm being metaphorical. But you're a fish. You can't talk to the other fish about water. They're like, yeah, what are you talking about? There's nothing other than what we're in.
Mm-hmm.
And when you take a step out of it and you can look back at it, then you can see it in its one view among many in the human condition, in the human situation. And many people have said, you know, it's this confluence of the Eastern worldview and the Western worldview that they're able to really fruitfully come together in this. That's what makes us the 21st century
mm-hmm.
lovers.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So can you elaborate a bit more about the confluence that you're talking about?
So we were saying a little bit earlier, like, from the point of view of just pure love, there isn't any divisions or types.
Right.
The types is this projection from the human attempting to understand itself in the human situation,
mm-hmm.
being in the human condition. Being a societal mammal, a mammal with language and familial ties and societal norms is productive of these various ways of looking at love through the types.
Right.
But I might go out on my further reaches of love and from the mystic perspective, from the Eastern perspective, and say that there's just two types.
What types are those?
Those types, I'm just saying,
yeah,
is love with grasping,
mm-hmm,
and loving without grasping.
Sounds simple.
Really? But the most difficult thing, the number one thing to contemplate,
mm-hmm,
for me and my relationships,
mm-hmm,
and to negotiate the relationships which were my development, you know, the relationships which I have the chance to heal or to repeat in how I'm raising my children and how I'm conducting my relationships, my partnership, etc. So it's really quite personal.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing is like when we're looking at an impersonal force like love, we say, you know, like Jason was so aptly saying, it's infinite.
Mm-hmm.
And we say it's like infinitely catalyzing your being. If we could just be love and awareness, boom, you're there. That's perfect. Being aware and being loving.
Boom.
You're there.
Yes. I do want to ask you, before I ask you more about the love without grasping and the love with grasping, more about that, something you had said a bit ago about experiencing the spiritual love and the love of, like, and service, love in the form of service, and how those two components, because I know those and I see those in Greek philosophy, and so I'm wondering how those tie into the Eastern philosophy that you're sharing. Those two components in particular, the spiritual love and the service love.
What are the, there's agape.
Yes, agape.
And philos.
Philos is the love of brother, like brotherly love.
Right.
We love our siblings. And agape would be the love, the selfless kind of love. And so that would sort of be probably the two.
Storge.
Storge, with love of the child.
Is affection.
Mm-hmm.
Friendship and affinity.
Right. And so I see how those, you know, are kind of separated out and defined in, like, the Greek philosophy. And so when you were referring to your experiences there as an 18-year-old meeting Ganesh Baba, was it... like, are you just outlining those two experiences that you had that fall under this sort of larger experience of love that, as defined in Eastern philosophy, or are you separating those out for any particular reason? Because you did call them spiritual love and service love.
Oh, right, right, right. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
It ties back in when we're saying, like, the practice.
Mm, gotcha. Mm-hmm.
And that... any meditation that you want to engage in, you know, mindfulness meditation, if you find, you know, from your exercise, your yoga practice, you get in the zone, what is able to bring your mind back to center and give you some peace,
mm-hmm,
as a practice, if you do that every day and you continue it for 10 years, and it becomes like who you are, you come from that place, then you start to get a different view, this larger view that is from the Western perspective, is from the Eastern perspective, then it becomes something practical.
Right.
So just that we're having this conversation, I am so grateful that there are so many talk shows everywhere across the air about mundane matters, you know, the stuff of commerce and the passing impermanent kind of world, the stuff, you know, we get hung about.
Mm-hmm.
To quote John Lennon, there's nothing to get hung about. But, you know, that we're talking about it here and making a space for it.
Right.
And then saying, oh, you know, I'm not necessarily an expert. Curiously enough, everyone is the expert of their own experience regarding love.
Right.
But that we want to make it something we can explore and deepen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're just holding a space for individuals to have a reflection upon that and see the value of that.
Right.
So, loving, that's with grasping, has an ownership field associated with it. And we could look at the different types of love from the Greek perspective and see it's because, you know, I have this definition of who I am socially. You have that definition of who you are. And then based on that, the bond that we negotiate, we call love.
Right.
And that can be very practical, that can be very beautiful. But to some degree or another, there's this reference to a self and an other, which on the relative level is very real. It's very much like a shared consent. We consent. There's a consensual reality that we agree to, and we all work, we all operate at that level. And we say how, like, karma operates at that level on the relative function, you know. It's very tangible, you know. Oh, I, through choices I made, I broke a heart. Woman was in love with me. I thought I was in love with her, you know. I was in love with her. Then the situation changes and I hurt her. Then, later on, I think I'm in love with this lady. She has love for me. But then it changes. She breaks my heart. In the romantic area, it seems like we make karma.
Mm-hmm.
And then we receive karma. And the understanding of it, we can't understand. It's just, when you're in it, it's so painful. It's so real. We can't understand this. We don't want to see this larger interrelationship, the larger interconnectedness that's at play in the relative reality. But then we go beyond, we say, oh, there's this absolute reality. Love in its pure form. Joy as the unbounded expression of life celebrating itself. Compassion as the deepest caring, you know, the most sublime kindness.
Mm-hmm.
And equanimity, where we don't make any judgments about you're close to me, you're far away from me. I push you away, and I hold this person tightly close because of the relative, because of the relationships based on the relative. The equanimity part, they say, you know, means like really seeing the equality, the basis within each being.
It's interesting because my mind, you know, wants to go to the area of like, I fully understand the concepts that you're sharing, but how that then applies to like the family dynamic, because therein lies, like, there is, in a sense, the, you know, in partnership, in marriage, like, the two partners and, you know, the protection of their family, or, you know, the survival of their mm-hmm. family. And in a sense that in a utopian world, in a perfectly mythical, mystical reality, the, you know, each neighbor would be caring for the neighbors as they would their own family.
Mm.
But how what you're sharing plays into the dynamic of the world that we live in, because that's
right.
not necessarily what happens.
And we're saying for the majority of human history,
mm-hmm.
we were tribal and with clans and bands, you know, if we go back 40,000 years, 100,000 years, they say, Aboriginal cultures in Australia. They're working in the familial, the extended familial unit. You have your blood relations, and then all your kin and the tribe, and that's the majority of human history. That's like what we're hardwired for, actually,
mm-hmm.
evolutionarily speaking.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like. Being in a small band or a tribe or a village is actually what feels more comfortable. Since the 50s, we had this idea of the nuclear family. Everyone's in their own castle. There's a king in his own castle.
Right.
And then there's not a moat around it, but there's a garage mm-hmm. where you park the cars. In old days, you know, the front of the house was like where other people could come. That's one of the beautiful things about Chico. It doesn't have the suburbs feeling, you know, that there's porches and front lawns, and that's how you meet the families. Everyone's there.
Right.
And if you go out into the suburbs, there's like a kind of a lawn thing, but then there's just this big driveway and the cars where they mm-hmm. park. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Culturally, socially, you know, we want to recreate, and what you're saying, it's very so
mm-hmm.
that on the relative level, of course, you have these natural affinities.
Mm-hmm.
You want to take care of those who are nearest to you.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing more natural.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, there's this larger aspect to love. And the Greeks would have a particular name for it.
Mm-hmm.
But we're saying it's inclusive of those who are near as well as those who are far.
Mm-hmm.
Or even those who appear to hold a completely different, a contrary political belief than your own.
Right.
They have love. They want to experience love and kindness as well.
Mm-hmm. So would it be safe to say that Eastern philosophy in regards to love aims to, or would inspire one that was following in the traditions of Eastern philosophy to minimize their affinities towards a particular one or family member?
No. That type of love you want to perfect. You
mm-hmm.
got to work with what's near you
mm-hmm.
first.
Right.
Even more importantly, work with who's the nearest to you first.
Mm-hmm.
Yourself.
Right.
Get that love really clean and clear.
Mm-hmm.
And we were saying it's a practice.
Right.
That it relates to something that you can engage in on a day-to-day basis
mm-hmm.
that starts to to give you good feelings, to give you some peace of mind, however it is, whatever it is, you know, that can become a practice for you that helps you cultivate, balance your mind, find some peace of mind. Mm. And you make that commitment to that,
mm-hmm.
and engage in it day by day, then you see it becomes part of your world and it changes how you look at things.
Okay. So I think I'm following you a bit more concisely here, that utilizing that relationship that you have with yourself to perfect a stronger practice of loving yourself, so that you can create that affinity with one individual or whoever, those people that are in your immediate environment, your family, and then to perfect that love, which then you can share even more bountiful with others. So you're perfecting it with yourself, perfecting it with those in your immediate surroundings, and then growing it versus like choosing.
All the more. Well said.
Okay, great. I'm glad that I'm following what you're saying. So I'm wondering if maybe you could explain a bit or tell us a story around the not grasping love and the grasping love. And right. how do you practice that? Like, do you have some real life practices for folks that are listening?
Well, that's the deep end right there.
Yeah.
That's the million-dollar question. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, this comes from the mentorship that I had with this brother Fritz that I've spoken about on a few occasions, and he was like an elder who was very powerful in the spiritual dimension. He had done like a traditional Tibetan Buddhist 3-year retreat, but in the jungles of the Amazon. So he's still kind of like this mythic creature to me, and to the people who knew him. And his one thing, the one thing that he would communicate, like how it all came down to simplify this vast system of philosophies in the Eastern mystical tradition, he would just say, it's not grasping, not apprehending. You know, what it came down to. And there's ways that I've approached that. The way that I'm thinking about it nowadays is that how thought gets you so far. There's modes of thinking. And the Greek were very, very keen on logic. They wanted to, like, they say, oh, you know, the greatest philosopher, Socrates, he applied logic to his own experience to the perfection, to the utmost. And so they made him drink poison. So I've talked with people about wisdom. What is wisdom, you know? And in the East, wisdom is something that makes the life happier, that makes the life more worth living, a practice of wisdom. In the West, they say, oh, you could have wisdom, but it might not make you happy. And, you know, it didn't work for Socrates.
Mm. Interesting.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because logic only gets you so far. There are other modes of thinking which are basic to us as beings. So logic is from point A to point B. Then there's a line in between. Circular is all the points between that encompass A and B without any differentiation. You can go, A is B. They're both parts of the circle.
Mm-hmm.
Chinese medicine is all about the yin and yang, the perfect circle. And the logic that Chinese medicine works on is circular. They even put it down. They're, oh, circular reasoning. That's not right from the logical point of view.
Mm-hmm.
From the poetic point of view, it's how we always think poetically. We want to encompass an idea or a direction, and we can't name it, we can't nail it, but we can live into it, we feel it. And music and poetry and all of that is a way that we approach something more perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
So that mode of thinking, Fritz would talk about. And also, you go beyond circular thinking to spherical thinking.
Hmm.
And you go beyond spherical thinking to boundless. And like, yeah, man, what's it all about? He's like, it's about not grasping. Loving, being love, and not grasping. That's what Fred said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Crazy old beautiful guy
mm-hmm.
that he was.
Pretty expansive. It's so simple.
Right.
Sounds challenging.
Right.
Yeah. Do you have any experiences that you care to share with us around that, around implementing that practice into your life? When was it that Fritz shared that with you?
Yeah, I was in my 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the perfect time because, mm-hmm. you know, I've had relationships and I was thinking about partnership.
Mm-hmm.
It was like that's the jump into hyperspace. You know, being a single guy, you can have relationships. And then being committed and having a family with kids, that's like the leap into hyperspace.
Hyperspace?
Right.
What's that?
You know, you're on the Millennium Falcon and you can zip around within this certain realm.
Mm.
But to really cover some distance, you got to engage the hyperdrive and go into hyperspace.
Gotcha. So that's in partnership, that hyperspace is in partnership?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think you got it. You have to do the calculations at the beginning before you make the leap, right?
Right. Otherwise, but you may not make it into hyperspace.
No, you might bounce off a star or a supernova and that'll be
and that's
okay.
It. New ship. All right. So you learned about it in your early 20s. And what was that like that? Do you remember like an internal transition for you that was taking place around that time when learning this idea of non-grasping but yet going into the hyperspace in partnership?
It's so hardcore because being in love, you know, it's so expansive. It's so liberating being in love.
Mm-hmm.
Your love is seeing you, the one that you love the most, is seeing you in the best possible light.
Right.
Oh, so delightful. such a rush, you know?
Yes.
Being in love. It's the way to start it. You got to fall in love.
Mm-hmm.
And then the power struggle. Who's going to call the shots? Who's leading the dance?
Mm-hmm.
We're doing our two-step. We're doing our dance. Who is the more active in that?
Mm-hmm.
That's the power struggle between two humans.
Mm-hmm.
Who is the most powerful? Even that enters into the love relationship. So sad. So true. And through it, through that dance, you get to relive and heal from those formative relationships. Your my mother, myself identifications that were made consciously, unconsciously, or disavowals, you know, first identification, then disavowal, pushing away from my father, myself, or the lack of the father, myself. So often in our culture, in our particular societal configuration, and my family, myself, my peer group, myself, my culture, myself, my society, myself. When we're forming the self-identity, we do it through these relationships, which is impersonal. It's there. It happens to us. Yet, it happens to us individually. We feel like it's the most astounding first thing that's ever happened. It's who we are. I was raised by these human beings who had their human limitations, their particular response to the human condition, their human foibles. How do I navigate that? Because I certainly made the karma for that. It happens, it occurs, and it seems like it's so very personal. And indeed, we do have to make it personal. Don't take it personal. Make it personal, because it is an impersonal process. There's an impersonal process of mental and physical phenomena. It's going on all the time. What are we going to do with it? What are we going to make of it? That's the question. We have this ongoing stream of phenomena of mental and physical qualities. What are we going to do of it? What are we going to make of it? How can we make it beautiful? Through love.
So bringing all those different areas that you're saying, like the different types of relationships that form us, form our identity, and meditating with them, sitting with them, contemplating those relationships, and in some way coming back to a place of love,
love
with all those
things. Forgiveness, deep forgiveness. And feeling forgiven. That's how we get to world peace.
Yeah. That's a big part of it, that feeling forgiven, allowing ourselves to be forgiven. It's a challenging one. I think sometimes it's almost easier to forgive others than it is to forgive ourselves for putting ourselves in certain circumstances, or for taking ownership over certain circumstances that maybe we had no control over.
That's right.
Yeah. Big one, forgiveness. Yes. Challenges. Talking Love in the 21st Century with Adam Mose, talking about Eastern philosophy in regards to love. So thought-provoking, Adam. Thank you for bringing your insights on love and perspective of oneself and building one's relation to their own self-love so that they can build relationships with others and eventually share that love overflowingly so with the world. What an amazing concept to begin to believe.
Why not?
Why not?
What else better?
Right. What else better? I'm on your side. I'm totally with you. Is there anything that you want to share with us as we are getting ready for Ecotopia coming up next? They're on every Tuesday from 6 to 7. I can see Steve and Susan getting ready for the show right now. They discuss environmental issues with nationally renowned authors and activists. EcoTalk, it's your local link to a global network of folks who know and care about the health of our planet. And yeah, as we are talking here on Love in the 21st Century about types of love and looking at it from the Eastern perspective. It's been a very thought-provoking hour and talking about love and love in action and the practice of love. And so I'm wondering if there's a few things you have left to say, Adam, as we transition.
Love your mama.
Love your mama.
Mama Earth, she's number one.
Nice.
We live and we perish. Humans, we either thrive or we don't,
mm-hmm.
based on our relationship with Mother Earth. So,
good wisdom to be sharing. If there's one thing that you take away from this show, go out and give love to your Mother Earth. Spend some time. I was just talking with a friend earlier today about that concept exactly. How much time do each of us, any of us, spend just with Mother Nature, just outside in her sweet arms and letting us know how well taken care of? You know, not enough time, most likely. Not enough time.
She wants to heal. She just wants to heal.
Mm-hmm.
All the plants have so much medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So much that they want to give to the humans all the time.
Yay. Love your mother. Mother Earth. Thank you, Adam, so much for being here. And we are going to be segueing here to Ecotopia here soon. I have a bit more for you. Someone that I listen to and am inspired by, his name is Preston Smiles. And this is a podcast he does, Questions with Preston, and it's talking about love will find a way. Everything else will find an excuse. So enjoy this. Stay tuned for Ecotopia coming up next. We love you, and we'll talk with you soon.
What up, y'all? Preston Smiles here, live from Mexico. Make sure you go to PrestonSmiles.com. And leave me your email because I release exclusive stuff only there. So today's transmission is make the call. I want you to think about right now and bring into your heart's mind someone you love with all of your heart. And I want you to imagine, God forbid, that they leave this earth before you tell them that you love them. You see, at the end of the day, nothing else matters. And there are people who we say we care about, who we say we love, that haven't heard from us in months. So today I'm challenging you to make the call, to reach out to your grandmother, to your mother, to your father, to your best friend who you've been fighting with for months. Because if they left this planet, I'm telling you right now, you know and I know that you would be devastated. And when we get to the end, if we can ever tell when the end is going to be, I promise you it won't matter how many cars you've had, it won't matter how many emails you've sent, it won't matter any of the stuff we call important right now. The only thing that will matter is whether you've shared that with them, is whether you've expressed the love that you have in your heart towards these people who love you. And people find out when they get to the inn on their deathbeds and when tragedy happens that that's the only thing that matters. And I'm challenging you today to drop into that space right here and right now. So call your mother. Call your father. Call your grandparents and let them know you care. Call your best friend and say, you know what? Yes, we've been fighting, but I don't care because I love you. Love will find a way. Everything else will find an excuse. Find a way today. Reach out. You see, the problem isn't the problem. Your attitude, your philosophy is the problem. You see, some people spend most of their time talking about and worshiping the problem than they do on the solution. But what you focus on, you grant reality into your life.
Hey guys, Will Durst here with the top 10 comedic news stories of 2016, which are not to be confused with the top 10 legitimate news stories of 2016. No. They are as different as cute kitten videos are from stainless steel collar stays, petroleum jelly in the cobblestones outside of 10 Downing Street, corn chowder in Michelangelo's David, trope and tripe. So these are they. The stories from the first 11/12 of 2016 that most lent themselves to the humorous, amusing, and comedic. Number 10, Fidel Castro dies, but at least hung on long enough to see the beginning of the end of American democracy. Number 9, the GOP primaries, a year-long circus featuring a lion tamer who used whips and chains and insults, questioning his opponent's energy, heritage, wife's attractiveness, and the size of their genitals. Number 8, Brexit. Turns out most Brits consider xenophobe to be a musical instrument. Number 7, the Chicago Cubs win the World Series, which Nostradamus cited as one of the signs of the apocalypse. Number 6, Bob Dylan wins the Nobel Prize for Literature, and next year, Stockholm is going to give the Peace Prize to Paris Hilton for her delightful tweets. Number 5, Melania Trump's GOP convention speech. Now, every time Michelle Obama talks, the world waits for Melania's spin on it. Number 4, Hillary Clinton's email problems. She says she was only following precedents set by other secretaries of state. And she's right. In 1790, Thomas Jefferson had server problems as well. The difference, his server was pregnant. Number 3, Bernie Sanders, who almost debated Donald Trump. Would have been fun to see the Vermont senator chew up the New York City real estate developer, but then be forced to spit him out due to religious dietary laws. Number 2, the Galaxy Note 7, promoted as water-resistant. What they didn't mention was underwater was the safest place to use the thing. And finally, number 1, Donald J. Trump, who won the U.S. presidential election with a little help from his friends. The FBI, Vladimir Putin, the mob, WikiLeaks, fake news stories, Anthony Weiner, Bill Clinton, Rosie O'Donnell, white supremacists, and Alec Baldwin. For KZFR Radio, I'm Will Durst.
In a perfect world, one we've never known, we would never need to face the world alone. They can have the world, we'll create our own. I may not be brave or strong or smart, but somewhere in my secret heart, I know love will find a way. Anywhere I go, I'm home. If you are there beside me, like dark turning into day,
so afraid. Now I realize love is never wrong, and so it never dies. There's a perfect world shining in your eyes, and if only they could feel it too, the happiness I feel with you. They know love will find a way. Anywhere we go, we're home. If we are there together, like dark turning into day, somehow we'll come through. Now that I've found you, love will find a way. I know love will find a way.
That was Love Will Find a Way from The Lion King 2. We'll leave those happy lions and tell you that this is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley. Here.